be able to tell you what is available legally in terms of relief for folks. And maybe there can be a conversation had with other community members working with incarcerated folks on what they need to feel supported.
Thank you both so much, and for your time and for sharing your experience with me and for sharing the film with all of us. Is there anything else that you think that I should know or that our listeners should know?
We have a take action section in our website. So if they wanted to, you know more about how they could help the survivors, there's a whole list of ways.
Awesome. All right, y'all. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Amy.
All righty. Take care.
Gastelum, you've been listening to Making Contact. If you want to know more about the film or about criminalized survival, you can go to our website, radioproject.org. Until next week.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO. KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
This is a journey into sound.
Brought to you in living color on
WTDR.
I'm Tony Epstein. It's the Magical Mystery Tour. Join us as we dive into the heart of things, exploring new ideas and new ways of seeing and being in this wondrous, crazy world we share together.
Lying on your back in the grass, you can't see a thing except for the clear blue sky, a few cotton wool clouds, higher and higher in the great dome of the sky, filling it with song. Higher and higher, filling it with song. Filling it with song. They sound quite mad, don't they?
It's a story, but that's why I'm here, to tell you stories.
So where to start? When you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but only a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood. Like a house in a whirlwind, or else a boat crushed by the icebergs or swept over the rapids, and all aboard are powerless to stop it. It's only afterwards that it becomes anything like a story at all, when you're telling it to yourself or to someone else.
Now, but one.
further down the line.
Today, we're going to hear about three revolutionary ideas for our time, beginning with Valerie Kaur, author of See No Stranger, a memoir and manifesto of revolutionary love.
There is a moment on the birthing table that feels like dying. The body in labor stretches to form an impossible circle. The contractions are less than a minute apart. Wave after wave, there is barely time to breathe. The medical term, transition. Because feels like dying is not scientific enough. I checked. During my transition, my husband was pressing down on my sacrum to keep my body from breaking. My father was waiting behind the hospital curtain, more like hiding. But my mother was at my side. The midwife said she could see the baby's head, but all I could feel was a ring of fire. I turned to my mother and said, I can't, but she was already pouring my grandfather's prayer in my ear. Tati vaunalagi pad brahmsanai. The hot winds cannot touch you. You are brave, she said. You are brave. And suddenly, I saw my grandmother standing behind my mother, and her mother behind her, and her mother behind her. A long line of women who had pushed through the fire before me. I took a breath. I pushed. My son was born. As I held him in my arms, shaking and sobbing from the rush of oxytocin that flooded my body, my mother was already preparing to feed me. Nursing her baby as I nursed mine. My mother had never stopped laboring for me. From my birth to my son's birth, she already knew what I was just beginning to name. That love is more than a rush of feeling that happens to us if we're lucky. Love is sweet labor. Fierce, bloody, imperfect, life-giving. A choice we make over and over again. I am an American civil rights activist who has labored with communities of color since September 11th, fighting unjust policies by the state and acts of hate in the street. And in our most painful moments, in the face of the fires of injustice, I have seen labors of love deliver us. My life on the front lines of fighting hate in America has been a study in what I have come to call revolutionary love. Revolutionary love is the choice to enter into labor for others who do not look like us, for our opponents who hurt us, and for ourselves. In this era of enormous rage, when the fires are burning all around us, I believe that revolutionary love is the call of our times. Now, if you cringe when people say love is the answer, I do too. I am a lawyer. So let me show you how I came to see love as a force for social justice through three lessons. My first encounter with hate was in the schoolyard. I was a little girl growing up in California, where my family has lived and farmed for a century. When I was told that I would go to hell because I was not Christian, called a black dog because I was not white, I ran to my grandfather's arms. Papaji dried my tears, gave me the words of Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh faith. I see no stranger, said Nanak. I see no enemy. My grandfather taught me that I could choose to see all the faces I meet and wonder about them. And if I wonder about them, then I will listen to their stories, even when it's hard. I will refuse to hate them, even when they hate me. I will even vow to protect them when they are in harm's way. That's what it means to be a Sikh, S-I-K-H, to walk the path of a warrior saint. He told me the story of the first Sikh woman warrior, Mai Pago. The story goes there were 40 soldiers who abandoned their post during a great battle against an empire. They returned to a village, and this village woman turned to them and said, "You will not abandon the fight. You will return to the fire, and I will lead you." She mounted a horse, she donned a turban, and with sword in her hand and fire in her eyes, she led them where no one else would. She became the one she was waiting for. "Don't abandon your post, my dear. My grandfather saw me as a warrior. I was a little girl in two long braids, but I promised." Fast forward, I'm 20 years old, watching the Twin Towers fall. The horror stuck in my throat, and then a face flashes on the screen. A brown man with a turban and beard, and I realize that our nation's new enemy looks like my grandfather. And these turbans, meant to represent our commitment to serve, cast us as terrorists. And Sikhs became targets of hate alongside our Muslim brothers and sisters. The first person killed in a hate crime after September 11th was a Sikh man standing in front of his gas station in Arizona. Balbir Singh Sodhi was a family friend I called uncle, murdered by a man who called himself patriot. He is the first of many to have been killed. But his story, our stories, barely made the evening news. I didn't know what to do, but I had a camera. I faced the fire. I went to his widow, Jaginder Kaur. I wept with her and I asked her, "What would you like to tell the people of America?" I was expecting blame, but she looked at me and said, "Tell them thank you." 3,000 Americans came to my husband's memorial. They did not know me, but they wept with me. "Tell them thank you." Thousands of people showed up because, unlike national news, the local media told Balbir Uncle's story. Stories can create the wonder that turns strangers into sisters and brothers. This was my first lesson in revolutionary love. That stories can help us see no stranger. And so, my camera became my sword. My law degree became my shield. My film partner became my husband. Didn't expect that. And we became part of a generation of advocates working with communities facing their own fires. I worked inside of Supermax prisons, on the shores of Guantanamo, at the sites of mass shootings when the blood was still fresh on the ground. And every time, for 15 years, with every film, with every lawsuit, with every campaign, I thought we were making the nation safer for the next generation. And then my son was born. In a time when hate crimes against our communities are the highest they have been since 9/11, when right-wing nationalist movements are on the rise around the globe and have captured the presidency of the United States, when white supremacists march in our streets, torches high, hoods off, and I have to reckon with the fact that my son is growing up in a country more dangerous for him than the one I was given. And there will be moments when I cannot protect him, when he is seen as a terrorist. Just as black people in America are still seen as criminal, brown people illegal, queer and trans people immoral, indigenous people savage, women and girls as property, and when they fail to see our bodies as some mother's child, it becomes easier to ban us, detain us, deport us, imprison us, sacrifice us for the illusion of security. I wanted to abandon my post. but I made a promise. So I returned to the gas station where Balbir Singh Sodhi was killed 15 years to the day. I set down a candle in the spot where he bled to death. His brother Rana turned to me and said, "Nothing has changed." And I asked, "Who have we not yet tried to love?" We decided to call the murderer in prison. The phone rings. My heart is beating in my ears. I hear the voice of Frank Roque, a man who once said, "I'm going to go out and shoot some towelheads. We should kill their children too." And every emotional impulse in me says, "I can't." It becomes an act of will to wonder. "Why?" I ask. "Why did you agree to speak with us?" Frank says, "I'm sorry for what happened, but I'm also sorry for all the people killed on 9/11. He fails to take responsibility. I become angry to protect Rana. But Rana is still wondering about Frank. Listening. Responds. "Frank, this is the first time I'm hearing you say that you feel sorry." And Frank says, "Yes, I am sorry for what I did to your brother. One day, when I go to heaven to be judged by God, I will ask to see your brother. And I will hug him. And I will ask him for forgiveness." And Rana says, "We already forgave you." Forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is freedom from hate. Because when we are free from hate, we see the ones who hurt us not as monsters, but as people who themselves are wounded, who themselves feel threatened, who don't know what else to do with their insecurity but to hurt us, to pull the trigger or cast the vote or pass the policy aimed at us. But if some of us begin to wonder about them, listen to their stories, we learn that participation in oppression comes at a cost. It cuts them off from their own capacity to love. This was my second lesson in revolutionary love. We love our opponents when we tend the wound in them. Tending to the wound is not healing them. Only they can do that. Just tending to it allows us to see our opponents, the terrorist, the fanatic, the demagogue. They've been radicalized by cultures and policies that we together can change. I looked back on all of our campaigns, and I realized that anytime we fought bad actors, we didn't change very much. But when we chose to wield our swords and shields to battle bad systems, that's when we saw change. I have worked on campaigns that released hundreds of people out of solitary confinement, reformed a corrupt police department, changed federal hate crimes policy. The choice to love our opponents is moral and pragmatic, and it opens up the previously unimaginable possibility of reconciliation. But remember, it took 15 years to make that phone call. I had to tend to my own rage and grief first. Loving our opponents requires us to love ourselves. Gandhi, King, Mandela, they taught a lot about how to love others and opponents. They didn't talk a lot about loving ourselves. This is a feminist intervention. Yes. Because for too long have women and women of color been told to suppress their rage, suppress their grief in the name of love and forgiveness. But when we suppress our rage, that's when it hardens into hate directed outward, but usually directed inward. But mothering has taught me that all of our emotions are necessary. Joy is the gift of love. Grief is the price of love. Anger is the force that protects it. This was my third lesson in revolutionary love. We love ourselves when we breathe through the fire of pain and refuse to let it harden into hate. That's why I believe that love must be practiced in all three directions to be revolutionary. Loving just ourselves feels good, but is narcissism. Loving only our opponents is self-loathing. Loving only others is ineffective. This is where a lot of our movements live right now. We need to practice all three forms of love. And so, how do we practice it? Number one, in order to love others, see no stranger. We can train our eyes to look upon strangers on the street, on the subway, on the screen, and say in our minds, brother, sister, aunt, uncle. And when we say this, what we are saying is, you are a part of me I do not yet know. I choose to wonder about you. I will listen for your stories and pick up a sword when you are in harm's way. Number two, in order to love our opponents, tend the wound. Can you see the wound in the ones who hurt you? Can you wonder even about them? And if this question sends panic through your body, then your most revolutionary act is to wonder, listen, and respond to your own needs. Number three, in order to love ourselves, breathe and push. When we are pushing into the fires in our bodies or the fires in the world, we need to be breathing together in order to be pushing together. How are you breathing each day? Who are you breathing with? Because when executive orders and news of violence hits our bodies hard, sometimes less than a minute apart, it feels like dying. In those moments, my son places his hand on my cheek and says, "Dance time, Mommy." And we dance. In the darkness, we breathe and we dance. Our family becomes a pocket of revolutionary love. Our joy is an act of moral resistance. How are you protecting your joy each day? Because in joy, we see even darkness with new eyes. And so, the mother in me asks, what if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our future is not dead, but still waiting to be born? What if this is our great transition? Remember the wisdom of the midwife. Breathe, she says, and then push. Because if we don't push, we will die. If we don't breathe, we will die. Revolutionary love requires us to breathe and push through the fire with a warrior's heart and a saint's eyes, so that one day you will see my son as your own and protect him when I am not there. You will tend to the wound in the ones who want to hurt him. You will teach him how to love himself because you love yourself. You will whisper in his ear, as I whisper in yours, you are brave. You are brave. Thank you.
That was Valerie Kaur.
اللهم اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد الفاتح لما أغلق، خاتم لما سبق، ناصر الحق بالحق والهادي إلى صراطك المستقيم، وعلى آله حق قدره ومقدار العظيم. Peace be upon you all. What's up? Yeah. So my name is Mona Haydar. Mona Haydar, if you're not anglifying my name, colonizing it. I grew up in Flint, Michigan. I was born in Saudi Arabia. I'm Syrian American. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I've lived in the Redwood Forest off the grid. I've lived at the Llama Foundation, for those of you who know what that is. I have lived in Saudi Arabia and Syria and Morocco, and now I'm here with you all, and I don't know why that any of that matters, but for some reason, place really matters. And we're here in this place right now together, and that matters. Our hearts are here together, and that matters. We're all here to come together for some greater good, some greater creation of love and light in the world, and I believe that from the depths of my heart. And first of all, I wanted to chant with you guys. You guys okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So in Arabic, the word for human, person, being, is insan. And the root word of that is nesayan, is to forget. The human forgets. What do they forget? Their original nature, what they come into the world with, the download. And we spend our lives acquiring more knowledge, but in that process of acquiring information, we sometimes forget that primordial and that part of us that is always there, but sometimes it gets forgotten, it gets covered up, it gets hidden. And we have these heartbeats, we have these hearts in our chest that they have a rhythm, they have a vibration, and they we're constantly chanting, whether we know it or not, through our breath, through our heartbeat, through our blood pulsing through our bodies. And the way that I was taught is that rhythm is Allah, Allah, Allah. And when you hear Allah, Allah, maybe you hear, the socio-political implications of that. But what I hear is breath, is life. Allah, 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 right? That animating spirit inside of all of us, that breath that enters our lungs when we're born into the world and that leaves our lungs when we leave the world. So Allah, 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 right? It's always there, whether we remember it or forget it. It's always there. And so the chant is Allah, 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 going. One more. La, la. So I have a question. What do you feel? This gentleman is doing this. I like that. What else do you feel? Say again.
Vibration.
Yeah, definitely. A resonance. Some people feel it really in their crown chakras. Some people feel it in their solar plexus. depends on what's going on for you. I think it's like a catch-all medicine, an opening, a closing, a healing, a salve. What else do you feel?
Oneness.
Expansion and oneness. Did anybody feel afraid? Right? This word has been weaponized, where you hear Allahu Akbar and it means something that it doesn't actually mean. It's been weaponized. And for me, that's a great tragedy, and it's a great introduction to the power of words and language, right? The power of good and bad, the power of right and wrong, these oppositional energies that are created in the universe. And for, in my tradition, we don't have a problem with theodicy. We don't have a problem of the problem of evil, because God in God's wisdom, the divine in the divine's wisdom, created good in the same way they created bad. Good and evil exist just as we exist, with all the beauty and good and potential that we can do, and all the harm and sorrow we can create. That all of it exists inside of us. You know, people ask me all the time, Mona, how are you, how do you have a master's in Christian ethics and are a Muslim and a rapper and a mom? Like, explain that. And for me, it's really challenging. Because I feel like it's, you know, like I have a cat. I have two cats, Mishmash and Amar, and I have two children. I should have mentioned them first, I guess. I have two sons and two daughters. The cats are the daughters. And it's like asking one of my cats if it is white with brown patches and black stripes, or if it's, you know, brown with white patches and like, it's like asking them to choose. Like, you don't have to choose one or the other. I don't exist in this world to make choices about my identity. My identity is just the collections of things I found beautiful and liked and admired and wanted them deliciously for myself, right? That, to me, is my identity. And sometimes it's the things that I hated and that I wanted to examine more, because inside of this microcosm that is a perfect model for the macrocosm, I get to really look at that ugly thing and decide if it really is ugly or not. And we have this mechanism in my tradition in our hearts that allows us to see beauty and allows us to see ugliness, and to recognize that the divine, in the wisdom of the divine, created both. That they both come from the divine. That I don't have to judge. That's not my work in this world. It's not my work to call this one ugly and this one beautiful, this one good, this one bad. It's my job. In my tradition, we call ourselves heart carriers. And the one job we have is to return this heart in a good, beautiful, pure state. That's the one job of a heart carrier, earth walker. That's the one job. We have these feet that are planted firmly inside of the earth, right? We're like trees. We have these roots that grow deep into the earth. And then we have these heads that are like way up in the sky. And somehow we manage to like not float up and not completely sink down, right? We're these earth walkers, heart carriers. And for me, it was always so interesting as a child that, you know, my mouth is here between my heart and my eyes and my mind. And I thought about that all the time. That, why is this here? And I always come back to the idea of balance. Balance and beauty, balance and beauty, balance and beauty. Right? And there's this story that I want to share with you all about balance and beauty. The Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, was sitting with his companions. And this is a desert in Medina where probably there were only 1,000 people in their community at the time. And they're sitting in the gathering space, the masjid, the temple. And it's an earthen floor. And to get to and from Medina, you have to travel long distances. And a man shows up, and he's dressed in pristine white. Pristine white. No signs of travel on him. And he rolls up into the prophet's mosque, and he's like, hey, what's up? Nobody knows who he is. And he sits knee to knee with the Prophet Muhammad. Knee to knee. You know, in the Eastern model, a teacher would sit like that with their student. You sit on your knees. And it was such an intimate position to be in for a person who was a stranger to the community. And he moved past that level of intimacy, and he placed his two hands on the thighs of the Prophet Muhammad. And the companions of the Prophet Muhammad are sitting around him in this temple. And they're witnessing this happen. And they're like, this is weird. We don't know this guy. And he's like, has his hands on the Prophet's thighs. Do with that what you will. And this man asked the Prophet Muhammad, Mal Islam? What is Islam? What is it to submit? The word in Arabic for Islam, the tradition I follow as a Muslim, is to submit. One who submits is a Muslim. And he says, what is Islam? And he says, Islam is that you do the actions. It's the form, right? You bear witness, you pray, you fast, you do these things, you give alms, you do the things. Right? You do the things. And he said, very good. The stranger said this to the prophet. He said, you've spoken truth. Now the companions are wilding out. They're like, I don't know who this guy thinks he is. And they're shook, right? And then he says, what is iman? He says, what is beauty? And the prophet says, iman, faith, is to believe in that which you cannot see. Believe in that which you cannot see, that you enter into a state that is beyond the physicality, the form, right? That you believe in the divine, and you believe in good and bad, that they both come from the Creator. And then he said, you have spoken truth. What is ihsan? Now, ihsan is a very interesting word. It is in Arabic, it's sort of hard to translate. I'm sure any of you who speak another language, sometimes you just have to use the other word, the word in the language that, you know, is indigenous to you or your mother tongue, because it just doesn't quite capture it, right? So ihsan is to make beautiful, is to make excellent. And so he says to him, what is ihsan? And he says, al-ihsan annaka ta'budu allaha ka'annaka tarah, fa'in lam takun tarah fahuwa yarak. That you worship God, you worship the divine as if you see the divine. And if you do not see the divine, you know that the divine sees you. And Arabic is a funny language. It has like little riddles and secrets and mysteries hidden inside of it. And if you pause at a certain place in that statement, it changes it completely. It says that you worship God, not as if you see God, but you worship God until you cease to exist inside of yourself. And then you will see God. You worship God, فَإِنْ لَمْ تَكُنْ, when you, in your individuality, cease to exist, you will see God. Right? And he said, أحسنت. Yes. Sadaqt. You have spoken the truth, that is what it is. And then he spoke about the fourth dimension of Islam, which is time. He asked him, when is the hour? When is the hour? And the Prophet said to this man, you know more of it than the one you are asking. The asker knows more of it than the one you are asking. And then he said, then what are the signs of the hour? And he went on to describe it. And in some interpretations of this story, there's a fifth dimension, which is space. And they come to talk about those signs of the hour, right? So you have form, physicality. You have that which you cannot see, right? Faith, the invisible. And then you have the combination of the two, right? When you, in your beauty and excellence, become harmonious, right? That you enter into a state of excellence. So everything you do becomes beauty making in the world. You become a beauty maker when your form matches up with your faith, right? And you don't have to do anything, right? You're no longer doing, because everything you do becomes worship in our tradition. Everything. Everything you say becomes excellence and beauty creating in the world. Everything your hand touches. And literally, this hadith goes on to say that the hand by which you do becomes God, and the eyes by which you see become God. You see through the eyes of God, you work through the hands of God. And what does that mean? It is to become a fully embodied and spiritualized being. And how do you do that? You do that by stopping trying. I had a teacher once say to me, Mona, if you would just, number one, stop trying so hard, and number two, try a little bit harder. He said, you could be a saint. Stop trying so hard and just try a little harder with everything. And so this question is always on my heart and in my mind. Did I do this thing excellently? Did I give it my heart? Did I allow my heart to unfold for this thing, for this person, for this conversation? Do I allow myself to be a muhsina, an excellence and beauty creator in the world? And how do I do that? By remembering. Duh, dummy, like remember. You don't have to do anything but be your most beautiful and pure and primal self. And that doesn't mean reverting to like babyhood. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about like really sitting in the essence of that which is beyond identity, and that which takes in all of the identity and embraces it lovingly and says that I love you and I see you and I honor you and I am so much more. And also, I'm nothing, right? And also, I exist in this liminal space, but I feel that I am so much more, that I'm eternal, that I'm infinite. How do I have a birth and a death experience, but I have this feeling that I'm gonna live forever? Don't we all feel like maybe we might live forever, like we might be the ones? Like maybe if we try, stop trying so hard and try a little harder, we could be the ones to live forever. And I'll tell you a secret, it's because we are going to live forever. Just not in this experience that we're sharing at this moment. And in this experience that we're sharing at this moment. And so in Islam, we don't have a problem of duality. We don't have this understanding of the world. Good and bad, right and wrong, it's all gravy, baby. It's all gravy, and it's all delicious. When your perspective shifts, when you attune your heart to deliciousness in the good, in the bad, in the ugly, you come to understand that it's all gravy. I wanted to leave you with one last thought, and that is, we are here. We are here, and we might live forever. And what are you going to do with that? If you know that this heart that you carry inside of your chest, this body, this spirit, is forever, how are you going to treat it? How are you going to be with it in this world? If it's forever, it's yours forever. Thank you.
That was Mona Haidar, and this is Pavi Mehta.
So people know the price of everything and the value of nothing. More than 100 years have passed since Oscar Wilde penned those words, and in that time we've managed to put price tags on things that Oscar couldn't have seen coming, not even in his wildest dreams. For instance, today, your company, for $10, can buy the right to emit a metric ton of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And for $250,000, you can purchase the right to shoot and kill an endangered black rhino in South Africa. We've managed to put price tags on life, death, and almost everything in between. So in a world where everything has a price, what happens to the priceless? This is the Golden Gate Bridge, not too far from where I live. It's arguably the most beautiful and perhaps one of the most photographed bridges in the world. It is a testament to our technical ingenuity, but it is also a testament to our moral failure. This is the second most common suicide site on the planet. This is John Kevin Hines. At 19, he suffered an intense bout of depression and showed up on this bridge. He walked through the crowds of tourists, and he had tears streaming down his face. He was looking for a moment of human connection. And that's when a young woman approached him, and she asked, "Can you take my picture?" She didn't notice the tears, didn't stop to ask how he was doing. John took the picture, gave her the camera, turned around, took three running steps, and jumped. He is one of the rare people who've jumped that bridge and actually survived. And one of the most haunting things that he shared since his rescue, if someone, if anyone had smiled at him that day, he would not have jumped. A smile. So we live in a time where we have mastered the art of liking each other on Facebook. We have forgotten the art of loving each other in real life. Disconnection is a growing epidemic, and it's not something that's just isolated to teenagers. It is a growing cancer in the workplace. A recent study showed that 70% of all people at work are emotionally disconnected. So, what are we going to do? What's the solution? Our sense of purpose doesn't lie in our commodities. It lies in our sense of communion. It doesn't lie in our products. It lies in the realm of the priceless. So what happens when we as leaders and thinkers bring those priceless gifts back into circulation? That's the beginning of something we like to call giftivism, the practice of radically generous acts that transform the world. Giftivism and giftivists have existed through all of history. People like Mahatma Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, people who believed that when you change yourself, you can change the world. But giftivism isn't just the sole property of social change giants like these. The seeds of it lie within each one of us. But to tap into that, we need to do something that these guys did. We have to upturn one of the fundamental assumptions of economics. The assumption of economics, the base of it all, is that all people act to maximize self-interest, the belief that people are inherently selfish. Giftivism turns that idea on its head, and it asks the question, what practices, what systems, what designs emerge if we assume that people want to be selfless? It's a really powerful question to ask. So we started a good news service, and we started to send every day inspiring real-life stories to people all around the world. We started a platform called KarmaTube, which is like a YouTube except only for inspiring and uplifting videos. We started a portal, a website that helps spread small acts of kindness. We started a generosity-based restaurant and a whole slew of other projects. And in all of these adventures in generosity, we discovered over and over again, generosity is generative. It creates new value. And giftivism organizes around that value through four key shifts. The first shift is from consumption to contribution. The average person in the city sees about 5,000 ads a day. The majority of that is subconscious. We don't even realize we're taking it in. So the marketplace primes us to consume. But the truth is, we are hardwired to contribute. And that's not wishful thinking, it's actual neuroscience. Research has shown that when people contribute to worthy causes, it lights up the same pleasure centers of the brain that doing something nice for yourself does. Giving literally feels good, and we don't need neuroscience to tell us that. We know it from experience. All of us have had that experience. So we started to experiment with unleashing a series of micro contributions. We started to do small acts of kindness. Things like paying toll for the person behind you at a toll booth, or buying coffee for a stranger at a cafe. Or we had a friend who was traveling business class, and spontaneously he decided to swap seats with an elderly woman who was traveling in economy. Now imagine being that woman, receiving that gift. What does it do? It fills your heart. It shifts the way suddenly that you look at the world. These counterculture acts, they're very small, but they light up the giver and the receiver. It's a win-win situation. And the thing is, generosity is not a zero-sum game. Then we created smile cards. These are small pocket-sized cards that you can carry around and pass on when you do a kind act. They tell the receiver, someone reached out, someone you don't know reached out just to make you smile, just to make your day. And you can't pay them back, but you can pay it forward. You can do something kind somewhere else for someone else and keep the spirit of this going. So this card becomes an invitation to unleash ripples of good wherever you are. Imagine a world where everyone walked around with these cards in their pockets, waiting for an excuse to make someone's day. This is important. It's not because it's some sort of feel-good exercise. This is important because as you do these things, it starts to rewire the way your mind works, individually and collectively. You stop walking through every door and asking in every situation, what can I take? Instead, you're asking, what can I give? What can I offer? What do I have to share? And when you make that shift, you start to catalyze a rich network of ripples. You start to tap into the joy of purpose. There's a beautiful quote from Gandhi. He said, the fragrance always remains in the hand that gives the rose. Then there's the second shift, from transaction to trust. Karma Kitchen is a prime example of this. Now, this is a restaurant that we started in Berkeley, California, and the unusual thing about it, there is no prices on the menu. At the end of the meal, guests receive a check for $0, and there's a note that explains, this meal comes to you as a gift from someone who came before you. And if you wish to pay it forward, you can make a contribution for someone who comes after you. To be honest, when we started this, we didn't have any clue whether it was going to work or not. Right? But the thing is, when you count on people to be generous, and you hold a context for that, and you create the systems for that, amazing things happen. It ignites something deep inside. So we had a volunteer once. He was a brilliant computer scientist, first time serving tables at Karma Kitchen, and he got the guest who was the most skeptical about this whole pay it forward idea. And so at the end of the meal, this guy calls the server over and gives him a $100 bill. And he says, you trust me to pay it forward? Well, here's the thing. I trust you to bring me back the right change. Not part of the plan. So this guy, he goes to the back, analytical guy, so he's running through all the permutations and combinations of what he can do. Should he split it 50-50? Should he try and calculate the average price of a meal? Should he try and see how many, you know, mango lassis that guy had? What's he going to do? And then suddenly, the answer comes to him, and it came from within. He walks back to the guest, hands him the $100 bill, then opens his wallet, takes out another $20, and says, sir, here's your change. And in that moment, both the guest and the server got what Karma Kitchen was about. They experienced a mini transformation, and it had nothing to do with the money. When you drop that habitual mindset of quid pro quo, you drop into the flow of giftivism. Things start to move beyond the control of your personal ego. You don't know where the gift came from, you don't know where your contribution is going to go, but you trust in the cycle of the whole. And in that context, every contribution becomes an act of profound social trust. And that kind of trust creates a web of resilience. Today there are 6 Karma Kitchens in cities around the world. Third shift, from isolation to community. The me mindset is super isolating and it's not very effective. But when you move from me to we, what happens? This is Pancho. He is one of the most fearless giftivists I know. And he lives by choice in a community in East Oakland. It's a neighborhood that's full of gang violence, poverty. There are more liquor stores than grocery stores on every corner. And yet the doors to Pancho's house, Casa de Paz, are never locked. There's a garden in the back where they grow fruits and vegetables. He does outdoor yoga classes for the community. He holds a weekly meditation gathering. Every weekend, he and his friends go around the neighborhood gathering unharvested fruit and vegetables from trees and fields. They organize this. This is Fruta Gift, where they gift vegetables, fruits, organic, ultra local to families in the community. And why is this important? It's important because it creates a context for people to share their gifts with each other. That neighborhood has been transformed. People there now clean the streets together. They grow gardens. They water each other's plants. They take care of each other's children. This is a place where when they used to hear bullets, gunshots, they would hide under their beds. Now they run out into the streets to see who needs help. When you move from isolation to community, you tap into the power of synergy, and you discover that the sum is always greater than the individual parts. The fourth and final shift is from scarcity to abundance. Scarcity is really a mindset. Gandhi once said that the world has enough for every man's need, but not enough for every man's greed. So when you move from that mindset of scarcity to thinking, I have enough in this moment, you start to discover new forms of capital. Money is just one form. You start to discover social capital, trust capital, synergy capital, and you start to unlock breakthrough models of abundance. That's what happened with this man. This is my granduncle. And it's such a joy to be able to share a little bit of his story with you. 37 years ago, he started an 11-bed eye clinic in southern India. No money, no business plan, no safety net. They had 11 beds, the country had 12 million blind, and his mission was to end needless blindness. They said, we're not going to turn anyone away who comes to us for help. 60% of the work that they do is done for free. They don't take any donations or do any fundraising, and yet they are a fully self-sustaining institute. How do they do this? The way it works is patients decide whether they want to pay or not. Those who can pay do, and they help cover the costs for those who can't. It is a simple, elegant, and breathtakingly compassionate system, and it really works. Quality outcomes are world-class, and whether you pay or not, you get the same high-quality treatment. Today, Aravind is the largest eye care provider in the world. They have seen over 38 million patients. They've done over 5 million surgeries. The majority have been done for free or at ultra-subsidized costs. They have redefined the impossible. Harvard Business School for the last 20 years has been doing a case on them. They, along with hundreds and thousands of other organizations and social enterprises, are looking at this model and saying, how does this succeed in spite of the fact that it breaks every rule of business? And the thing is, this doesn't work in spite of the fact that it breaks those rules. It works because it breaks those rules. So giftivism isn't some sort of utopian dream for a distant future. It's a priceless inheritance that we can tap into in this moment, and the rewards are built in. When you move from consumption to contribution, you tap into the joy of purpose. When you move from transaction to trust, you build a web of resilience. When you move from isolation to community, you tap into the power of synergy. And when you move from a mindset of scarcity to one of abundance, you discover radically new possibilities. I began this talk with the story of one desperate teenager. I'm going to close with the story of another. This is Julio Diaz. As he was walking home late one night from work, he was approached by a teenager with a knife who said, "Give me your wallet." Julio handed over his wallet, and as the boy turned to run, Julio said, "Wait, you forgot something." The boy turned around, and Julio said, "You forgot to take my coat. It's a cold night, and if you're going to be out here robbing people all night, you're going to need this." Now, in the history of robbery, I'm not sure if that's ever happened before, but it had never happened to this boy. He took the coat. And then Julio said, "Are you hungry? There's a restaurant down the street. Would you like to have dinner together?" And incredibly, the boy said, "Yes." So they walk over to the restaurant. And there's Julio. Imagine, he's sitting there dining with his robber and treating him with nothing but compassion. And at the end of the meal, Julio looks over to the boy and he says, "You know, I'd really love to buy you dinner, but you have my wallet." And the boy slides the wallet across the table. And then Julio leans forward and he says, "I need to ask you for one more thing. Can I have your knife too?" And without a word, the knife comes across the table. What we will do for love will always be far more powerful than what we will do for money. What we can do together will always be far greater than what we can do alone. And when we tap into the heart of giftivism, in ourselves, in our companies, in our communities, we begin to unleash our true prosperity. We start to move from being a market economy to being part of something far greater, a gift ecology. And it begins with small steps. I'd like to leave you all with a question. What is your small step today? What is your giftivist resolution? Take a moment to hold that question in your heart. May we take that step. May we change ourselves, and may we change the world. Thank you.
That was Pavi Mehta. And that's it for this Magical Mystery Tour. Thank you so much for listening. If you missed any of the show or would like to hear it again, you can find this and all Magical Mystery Tour shows at soundcloud.com/WGDR. And until next time, take good care of yourselves and each other.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal